The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I haven't been here in a while, and it's really lovely to see all the changes in the building inside and outside. And I'd like to thank Maria Stratman, I doubt if she's here, for calling me and for arranging to have Daniel and Inez speak for sessions 1 and 2. I appreciate their contributions in introducing and clarifying various aspects of right speech or wise speech. I know Daniel spoke briefly about the 5 do's and don'ts, and Inez elaborated on them. He also talked about the importance of mindfulness and intention, and both of them offered useful tools for cultivating the practice of right speech. If you were unable to attend their talks, I believe they're going to be or already on the IMC website, and I really suggest listening to them. Tonight I would like to continue the discussion about wise speech within the general framework of sila. I'm sure you've heard that word here before. It constitutes 1/3 of the Buddha's Eightfold Noble Path. It's usually translated as morality or virtue or ethical behavior, and it has to do with how we conduct ourselves in community in relation to others. It is the external manifestation of what we feel and think. It is how our inner intention or motivation gets expressed outwardly. And the 3 steps that constitute sila, which you probably have heard before, are right speech, right livelihood, and right conduct. We can also discuss sila in terms of the 5 precepts that guide daily life, and I'll go into those shortly. One of the things that I've learned in studying and practicing the Dharma is that when we engage in any one aspect of it, we wind up integrating all aspects because every part of the Buddha's teaching is interconnected. In order to practice wise or skillful speech, we need to practice everything else. The other 7 steps on the Eightfold Noble Path, the 4 Brahma Vihara, the divine or sublime abodes, loving kindness, compassion, altruistic or sympathetic joy, and equanimity. We need to practice the 10 paramis, the 10 perfections, generosity, resoluteness, energy, wisdom, and so on, patience. Also the bojanga, the 7 factors of awakening or enlightenment, and so on. Any time you focus on one part of it, you wind up having to bring in all the other parts. And you've probably already noticed this in your practice. This became especially clear to me while working on the book that Maureen mentioned about Munindra, a Bengali meditation master who wound up spending 9 years in Burma and later became before that he became the first Buddhist superintendent of the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya. For the longest time, everybody thought it was a Hindu temple, and then there was an archaeological dig, and it turned out that it was actually a Buddhist temple, and the Bodhi tree was there where the Buddha experienced his enlightenment. And so Nehru decided, after India became independent, that it would become a Buddhist temple again, and Munindra became the first Buddhist superintendent there. He was also Joseph Goldstein's first teacher. He was also a teacher to Sharon Salzberg, Daniel Goleman, Ram Dass, and so many Western Dharma teachers. And in this way, he was instrumental in transmitting the Dharma to the West and influencing the emergence of the mindfulness movement that we experience in psychology, sports, not just in meditation centers, education, business, and many other arenas. So each chapter in the book focuses on a particular quality and the qualities that are necessary in the journey toward awakening. Asila is one of them. I noticed that when I was working on the book, every time I wrote about an anecdote that illustrated how Munindra embodied this quality in his everyday life, I would wind up in a quandary. Does the story really belong in this chapter? I mean, it's about loving kindness, but it's also about mindfulness and equanimity. And it's also about patience, and it's about resoluteness. So which chapter does it belong to? In the end, I wound up just making arbitrary choices about where to put the anecdote. And somebody else might place it somewhere else. But it taught me a really important lesson about trying to organize material around categories of spiritual qualities. So in speaking about right speech, I cannot point to any one quality that stands alone in facilitating more wholesome speech. Certainly we can't do without mindfulness, but then we also need to factor in our intention. And we need to bring in loving kindness and compassion in how we see others and how we treat them. And of course we need to remain patient and equanimous, especially when others get angry and speak offensively at us, to us. And we need to give energy or effort to the practice and be determined in carrying it out, and so on. You've probably already noticed this in your practice, but if you haven't, keep it in mind. I'd like to share a bit of background regarding how I came to put attention on wise speech in the first place. My interest arose after an uncomfortable experience with a dear friend around our communication about a third person. Afterwards, when I reflected on what happened, I realized that it reminded me of a deep-seated pattern in the dynamics of my family of origin. And that was not what I would call a wholesome pattern. Maybe other people here have, you know, can think back to you know, our parents did the best that they knew how to do, and given the circumstances that they went through, and my parents went through really, really awful circumstances. So this is not about blaming. It's just about understanding, you know, that was then. We need to acknowledge, we need to recognize, acknowledge, and then do the work to transform that pattern rather than perpetuate it. So this gave me an opportunity to work on that. And when I felt the negative repercussions of the experience, it made me realize that I had to go beyond my meditation practice. It was my main practice, and we often think if we have a spiritual practice, it's going to church or chanting or meditating, but really it's about what we do every day, especially with other people. Other beings in general. So I decided I needed to examine more closely what's involved in the practice of right speech. So I used the unfortunate incident as an impetus for my doctoral research, and I wound up writing a dissertation about how we transform everyday speech habits into a spiritual practice. I'll call it of ethical speech, because not everybody understands what right speech means. I mean, people outside of the Dharma world, if you say right speech, they're going to think you mean grammatically correct. So I decided if I was going to subject myself to several years of intense academic work, and I had already been to graduate school in another field, so to put myself through this again, I decided it had to be really useful to me, and hopefully that it would be of benefit to others as well. And so that it would help me in my personal development or my spiritual evolution. So to make my studies as practical as possible, I decided that I wasn't going to have it be simply theoretical. I was going to interview people who have been on the spiritual journey a long time and who could share with me what it was like for them to cultivate ethical speech or right speech or wise speech. And what I did was I interviewed Dharma teachers of different Buddhist schools, and I also interviewed rabbis of different denominations so that I was able to do a cross-cultural study. So anyway, that's how I got involved in all of this. And tonight I'm going to share some of the wisdom that I learned from the Dharma teachers. First, I think it would be helpful to review what the five basic precepts are. Please remember that these are not commandments handed down by a deity, but they're recommendations for ways of being in community. We don't obey them. We volunteer to do them, to work on them. That's why when we recite the precepts, the wording is, I undertake the training to abstain or refrain from, one, harming living beings, which is another way of saying nonviolence. Two, from taking what is not given, or non-theft. Three, from engaging in sexual or sensual misconduct. Four, from uttering false speech, so that's not lying or deceiving. And the fifth one is from indulging in intoxicants that cause heedlessness. If you examine these precepts, you'll probably notice that in one way or another, all of them refer back to number one, about non-harm. Because through the lying, or through intoxication, or through sexual misconduct, or through theft, there's harm that is done to someone and also to yourself. And this winds up being the basic criterion of morality according to the Buddhist teaching. Maybe some of you have heard this advice that the Buddha gave to his young son Rahula, and I'm going to share some of that. Rahula, when you wish to do an action by speech, you should reflect upon that verbal action thus. Would this action by speech lead to my own harm, or to others' harm, or harm to both? Is it an unwholesome verbal deed with painful consequences, with painful results? If you know that it would be conducive to suffering, then you definitely should not do it. But if upon reflection, you know that this action by speech would not lead to your own harm, the harm of others, or to both, that it is a wholesome verbal deed with pleasant consequences, with pleasant results, then you may do such an action by speech. The Buddha also advised his son to ask this question while engaged in the action. So he asked, if there's no harm and the results are pleasant, then continue this action by speech. Then after having done the verbal deed, ask yourself the question again. If you conclude that it was wholesome and did not result in suffering, then allow yourself to feel happy and glad and keep training day and night in wholesome states. In asking ourselves this question, we have a really practical guideline that we can apply to speech in any arena, in the workplace, at home, with friends and neighbors, in our country, and in the world. And at any time, before, during, and after speaking. It's a pretty basic question. And such a question takes into account all sentient beings, human and non-human. And I blew that one today. I had a 2.5-hour ride to the Bay Area before an hour coming here. And so I needed to walk my dog. And I took my dog to Point Isabel Park. And he's only a year old, and we've been doing obedience training. And he's been really good. And he was really bad today. And I didn't even stop to think about the tone in my voice because I was trying to keep him from going into the water. Because when he came out, he was covered with mud. And I had no place to wash him off. And I was just livid. And I didn't stop to ask myself this question. You know? And afterwards, I reflected. And I was unhappy about what I had done. But I was also unhappy with him. So it was a hard call, but I could really feel in my body how not good it felt to talk to him the way that I had. Even though he doesn't maybe understand my words, he certainly understood the tone in my voice. So can we honestly say that our communication is nonviolent? Or is it violent, whether grossly or subtly, to anyone? And this alone can help us sort through what to say, how to say it, and when to say it, or maybe not to speak at all. Clearly, we can't always foresee the consequences, but we can look at our motivation for speaking. We can discern whether we want to do harm or not. Maybe we want to strike back verbally at someone who has hurt us, or maybe we want to heal the rift. And so, just asking ourselves that question can help us decide what to do. Now I'd like to take a look at how we can interpret the five precepts vis-a-vis speech. And I bring this up because it's something that a teacher in the Zen tradition shared with me, one of the people that I interviewed. Only in her case, she expanded her practice of right speech by working with the 16 bodhisattva precepts that were part of her ordination. But I'm going to keep it basic and simple tonight. We'll just do the five that are part of the Theravada tradition. You may have also already realized that when we talk about refraining from doing something that is unskillful, we state it in a negative way. Don't lie, don't steal, don't get drunk, whatever. The flip side of that is engaging in something skillful. And we state it in a positive way. Be truthful, be generous. As I mentioned earlier, the first precept is about not harming or not killing. We can say that not killing means speaking in such a way that gives life. For example, that respects the life of a conversation. So we can understand interruption as a form of killing speech, except in Israel. Last week, Inés pointed out that someone told her that interrupting is considered a sign of interest in the conversation, and not interrupting means that you don't care. So you have to consider cross-cultural differences in applying these things. Also, if we engage in malicious speech, in slander, we could kill someone's reputation and livelihood, and that in turn could harm the well-being of that person's family. I'm sure you can come up with your own examples of how someone else gossiping or spreading rumors about you could have a violent effect on your job, your business, or your own family. It's so easy to do. Unfortunately, it's something that happens so easily, and people don't understand how spreading malicious speech about someone, it's almost like killing the person. Consider that the opposite of harm is kindness and compassion. So if we focus on being kind and compassionate to others, we're less likely to be verbally violent. So So you don't have to necessarily think, I don't want to be violent. You could say, I want to be kind and compassionate. And then automatically, you won't be violent. The second precept. Not taking what's not given means, for example, not taking the floor when we don't have it. Not taking status or power when we don't have it. Through shading the truth or doing other things that aren't necessarily in line. And Ajahn Amaro, has he been here recently, Ajahn Amaro? No. I interviewed him for my dissertation, and he illustrated this for me in the following story. Let's say he wants a solar panel for his cabin in the woods at Abhyagiri Monastery so that he can have some electricity there. And he explained, that's the basic desire. Then the mind starts working. Well, this was talked about last year, and we never got it together to put the solar panel in, and I want some electricity. How can I bring it up? How can I phrase it so that it will become something that everybody else says is a good idea, so that it won't look like me hassling the others to get what I want? And he laughed when he told this to me. He said, the tongue is being employed to disguise my craving. His advice is that when you know that there's an intention to deceive, maneuver, or manipulate, then don't say a word. Just zip it. Watch what's going on in your mind and zip it. I think eventually he did get electricity, but not because he manipulated for it. So consider that the opposite of taking what's not given is being generous. Instead of taking the floor, you give the floor for someone else to speak. Or you give positive comments to others rather than tearing them down with your criticism. One of the patterns in my family of origin was a great deal of negativity. No compliments, no positive comments. And there's a reason for it, but it's way too long to go into. And I remember when I did get a compliment someplace else, how wonderful it felt. And I made a point of learning how to give positive comments to other people, because the negative part, it felt awful. It's not a building up. And I don't mean building up of ego, but just a building up of either self-esteem or confidence, whatever it is, as opposed to the negativity, even though there's a certain kind of training in that, it doesn't strengthen in a positive way. The third precept about not misusing sexuality or sensuality could also be about not misusing the intimacy of speech, not creating a false intimacy with speech, but sticking with the intimacy that's appropriate to the situation and the relationship. How often have we used our words and tone and body language, especially by talking about someone else, to create a sense of false intimacy or closeness? I believe Inés mentioned this last week in her talk. Has anyone ever sweet-talked you into doing something? Think of a time in your life when this has happened and how it harmed you, maybe undermining a positive sense of yourself or even leading to drastic results. Consider the opposite. Instead of creating false intimacy, you create true and honest intimacy with someone. And imagine the kind of relationship that would arise from that, the big difference. The fourth precept is refraining from false speech. Inés spoke about the consequences of lying, and she talked about how she learned lying in her family and what it meant in terms of trust and how she overcame that. Not being honest in our dealings with others and in our business eventually kills the trust that others have in us. It could mean the death of a relationship. Look what happened because of lies about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Those lies not only killed our trust in the president and the government, but actually resulted in the deaths of so many people, and that's still happening every day. Not to mention economic death in this country and in the rest of the world. Now, I'm not saying that what happened in Iraq is causing the economic crisis in the rest of the world, but there is a chain reaction from one place to another. And what happens in the United States affects other countries. Consider what telling the truth means and having the courage to do so. I'm not talking about truth-telling that causes pain in others, but truthfulness that engenders trust and intimacy and that helps break down barriers between different kinds of people. The last precept is about intoxication. Clearly, some people are intoxicated with the sound of their own voice and can't stop talking. My husband has hundreds of clients, and he has said to me, people love to hear the sound of their own voice. You know, we all do this. I mean, some people are not big talkers, but a lot of us like to talk. And people who are intoxicated with the sound of their own voice kill any possibility of a real dialogue and eventually can even kill a relationship because they don't know how to pause and listen. Consider that abstaining from intoxicants can mean abstaining from saying too much and getting drunk on your own words. Remember the Buddha's counsel to Rahula. It's not only about harming others, but also about hurting or harming yourself or both. This is pretty basic, but if you try it out, you'll find that it holds for any situation, such as intimate relationships and interactions with coworkers. The Zen priest I interviewed told me that when she was going through a divorce, she brought a copy of the precepts with her to the proceedings. That's pretty radical. I mean, is anybody here a divorce lawyer? And she said that by referring to them, not the lawyers, but the precepts, she found that they helped her get through the unpleasantness of the experience and also to avoid poisoning herself with hatred and bitterness. Another anecdote she told me is about working with a group of people. When she was head cook in her community, she realized that her kitchen crew was experiencing a meltdown. So she asked them what was going on, and the response was that people were criticizing each other a lot. For instance, someone would do X, I don't know, whatever they did wrong. And another person would jump on that individual. You're not doing that right. I don't like working with you. Why don't you ever wash your T-shirt? So that really had a lot to do with the work. But this is what happens. You know, you say one thing, and then it's like unloading a gunny sack full of all your all the things that you've been carrying around. So she sat everyone down, and she had the entire crew make a pact that no one would criticize anyone except on the basis of their actual intention in working together. They would meet regularly and come up with a statement of intention that everyone agreed on. And then they would recite that intention every afternoon. If somebody wanted to criticize another person in terms of the intention itself, that was okay. But for all other things, they had to ask permission to speak. And an interesting thing happened. Once they established this as a habit in the crew, they actually became really close, and they were able to talk about things intimately instead of picking on each other. They shared an intention, and at the same time, they had friends who helped each other in fulfilling that intention. The value of having a Sangha. I also interviewed Aitken Roshi, who is an elder in the Western Zen community. He's now in his 80s. I think he was either 82 or 84 when I interviewed him, and this is quite a number of years ago. He says that right speech is perhaps the ultimate test of inclusion. You honor your friend and your adversary alike. That's the kindness and compassion toward all beings. He says that the Buddha was not talking about right as the opposite of wrong, nor was he talking about correctness. Instead, right refers to the innate nature of the universe and its beings. Aitken Roshi calls it our interbeing. Although each of us is unique, we're also ephemeral, without an abiding self or soul, and we come forth through the co-arising of different causes and factors. So we can also think of right speech as communication that is suitable or appropriate to the person and situation, rather than a hard and fast rule. You know, the Buddha didn't give hard and fast rules. He basically said, ask yourself, is this going to lead to suffering or is this going to lead to happiness? So in different situations, what you say and the tone you use, I remember my very first Vipassana teacher told the story about, you know, if a child runs out into the street and you yell or grab the child to come back to avoid getting hurt, that's appropriate for the situation. You don't stand on the corner and say, Billy, I think you should come over here now, because the car is speeding down the street. You have to act. But you wouldn't use that tone of voice and jerk on somebody when it's not appropriate. And that's why the Buddha didn't give hard and fast rules, but that you examine each situation and then act accordingly. Joseph Goldstein shared with me that some thoughts that he has about gossip, one of the difficulties in practicing right speech. He said, you know, it's really difficult seeing the line between what's just gossiping about people and appropriate sharing of information. He said, I try to look at my motive. I think it all comes down to motivation. That's where the mindfulness and the metta are so important. Okay, what is my motive in doing this? Is it really just to gossip, or is there some skillful motive? So again, it's not about never talking about anybody else, never sharing any information, being silent all the time, but it's about understanding when it's appropriate and when it's really unskillful. So what helps us or hinders us in carrying out wise speech? For Joseph, holding kindness and respect as a strong value informs his decisions about what to say, how to say it, and when to say it. He said that what enables him to follow a steady diet of right speech is how it makes him feel. It feels much better. It's definitely conducive to happiness. It makes for a happier, lighter, more easeful mind. So you just get immediate feedback to know this feels good, this doesn't feel good. I'd like to continue doing this. I don't want to continue doing that. I also interviewed Lama Kunga in the Tibetan tradition, and he said, it's important to avoid inauspicious environments and choose carefully whom to speak with and about what. And he was so funny. He quipped to me, well, you know, I don't hang around in bars. So, you know, and I only talk about certain things. So think about where you hang out and whom you hang out with. This is a great place to hang out. Do the people have a positive influence on your speech, or do they lead you to break the precepts? Find people who care about right speech and are learning to hold it up as a value. Make those people your buddies. People right here in the room. Similarly, notice models around you. The Zen priest told me that even having some negative models in her childhood was useful because she got to see what not to do. And she found positive models to show her what to do, from her own sisters to teachers to clerks who genuinely say, "Have a good day," when they give you change for your purchase. And she even cited flight attendants. She said, "Just think about it. The words they're using are all about taking care of your safety in the airplane." And she said, you can look all around and find, you don't have to just look to Dharma teachers as your models, but look for people in your community who show you a positive way of being in the world. Something that I find effective is making sure that mind, body, and speech are of a piece, that they're congruent. And what happened for me today with my dog was, toward the end, I was in a rush because someone was waiting for me and I had to finish the walk and get to this person's house. And because he got all muddy, I was then flustered and worried about my time. So things were not congruent in that moment for me. It's important to take care of the body. It's what allows us to practice, since the mind is not disembodied. At a fundamental level, we can ask ourselves, am I getting sufficient rest and nourishment so that I feel well enough to resist unwholesome tendencies? Over the years, I've learned that when I'm tired or if I have a migraine, that's not the best time to talk. I don't feel strong enough. My vulnerability is high and my resistance is low. And I'm more likely at a time like that to revert to default mode, the kinds of things I learned in my family, that we all learned in our families. It's possible that irritability rather than mindfulness will take over. And later I'll regret what I said or how I said it because my timing was off. So I check in with the body to discern what's going on. Am I in the right physical condition to handle the situation skillfully? If not, then all I have to do is let the other person know that this is not a good time and make arrangements to speak at another time. This is something that I worked out with my husband. He wanted to get to something right away, take care of it. He's a very business guy. And in that moment, I would be either tired or confused, and it just wasn't working out right. So I learned to say, honey, I really can't talk about this now, but let's do it tonight or tomorrow, whatever, you know. Unless it is a life or death emergency situation, you don't have to respond in this moment. It's not, again, unless it's life or death, you can postpone speaking at a time that will be more suitable so that you can actually practice right speech. Ask yourself what your default mode is when conflict arises. Just take a moment. Do you withdraw and become non-communicative? Silence is crucial to right speech, but not when it's a passive-aggressive reaction. Or do you react angrily, raising your voice and arguing for the rightness of your position? If I remember correctly, in the first talk, Daniel said that he learned it's more important to experience peace and happiness than to insist on being the one who is right. After all, both parties can be right and wrong. So get to recognize your default behavior, your automatic reaction, and then explore new ways to respond instead. You can use the body to help you. Get a sense of your breathing before it's your turn to speak. Is it fast and shallow or slow and deep? It will indicate whether you're anxious or at ease. Notice whether you're experiencing tension or tightness in the neck, in the shoulders, in your scalp, your eyes, or maybe you feel like butterflies in your abdomen. Are you breaking out in a sweat, or are you shivering with cold? The body can behave in these ways without any environmental changes in temperature. Learn to understand your body's cues and clues as to what you're feeling. It's easy to deceive ourselves and say, "Nope, that doesn't bother me. I don't care." But if somebody looks at your face or body posture, they know you're angry, upset, no matter what you're saying. And you can look for physical signs in the person you're speaking with as well. For example, if you sense fear, the violent thing to do is to take advantage of it and become even more aggressive toward the person. You may be able to cow the person with your speech and your posture, your tone of voice, but will you come to an amicable resolution? What if you were to try being kind instead? This reminds me of a story that I heard from someone I interviewed for the book on Manindra. He told me he learned a powerful lesson from Manindra, from some advice he once gave him. And what happened was this man, I'm making up a name, I'm going to call him Paul, so I don't have to keep saying this man. And he was doing guided sittings with Manindra in Honolulu. There were also interviews so he could talk things over with the teacher. And in one interview, Manindra asked him, you know, what's going on in your life? And Paul wanted to tell him he was having a hard time in his job because, as he put it, and this is what he said to me, he was working with a boss who was a complete jerk. He called him the supervisor from hell. But when Manindra asked him the question, Paul kept wondering to himself, should I tell him about this? Is this something I ought to be talking about to him? I mean, this is about my work, you know. It's not about my spiritual life. And then he laughed, and finally Paul said to Manindra, well, Manindraji, there is something that is kind of bothering me. I have this situation at work. I have this boss and yada, 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 yada. Manindra sat there listening for about a minute or so and then said, and Paul thought this was probably on a Sunday, and Manindra says, I'll tell you what you should do. First thing tomorrow morning, you walk right into his office and you apologize and say to him, I am sincerely sorry for any kind of misunderstanding, tension, or problem we may have had, or I may have caused for you in our relationship. And I want to ask for your forgiveness and to tell you that it's my intention to be cooperative and to work as much as I can in a way that you will find acceptable and pleasing. And when Manindra said this, Paul's first reaction was, no way, get out of here. I'll never do that. And Manindra looked straight at him and said, and when Manindra was serious, he said, no, no, you must do this. You need to do this. You really need to do this. And Paul said, Well, I'll think about it. Okay. And Paul told me, of course, my ego and my pride simply wouldn't allow me to do that, you know. But I went home and I thought about it. And I realized, of course he was right. But my ego and my irritation and anger. So I didn't do it on Monday. But I think I did it on Wednesday. I finally did go in and see my boss and told him basically what Manindra said. I don't know how much it influenced him, but I think it sort of softened my boss a little bit. It took away whatever excuse he had for being mean to me. But that was kind of a counterintuitive response to a situation that in the beginning threw me for a loop. I mean, it's not the kind of thing you would normally do. This is Paul. But it is how you would deal with difficult people in your life in a dharmic context, to remove any cause for anger or ill will as much as you can. Of course, I didn't change my boss, but our relationship did improve slightly after that. So the next time you find yourself in a conflict-ridden situation, try to come up with what's a counterintuitive response and try it. I mean, what can happen? If your boss is already mean, or whoever you're dealing with, probably they'll not get meaner. You'll just shock them so much they'll have to do something different. However, I mean, really, I'm not advising anyone here to go and do the same thing that Paul did. Your response to people in your life has to be appropriate to the situation. So you really need to think it through. Again, there's no hard and fast rule. So what I would like to do is pass out these 3x5 index cards that I brought. And you can start in this direction. If you could start in this direction and then give somebody in the middle cards to pass out. Do you have pens with you?
No.
Okay, well then, hold on to the card and just think about this. And you can write when you get home if you feel like it. Because I only have 3 pens and there are more than 3 people here. So what I'd like you to do with the card is first, think of an intention that can help guide you in your daily speech. It can be anything. You know, you just come up with it. It can be, I see each person as my friend, or I see no one as my enemy, or, yes.
I don't think
oh, did you not get cards?
Okay.
There are more cards. I mean, if you don't want to do the intention, you don't have to, but I'm giving you this opportunity. Try something new. Or you could write, I avoid cursing at anyone. Or I pause for 10 seconds before I respond. Or I keep my voice down even when my anger arises. Or I am mindful of how I feel in the body before I speak. Or I allow for space in the conversation and do not interrupt my partner. My husband jokes about this. He'll say, oh, you've already finished what I was going to say because I've interrupted him. And again, that's a pattern that I learned in my family. If you didn't interrupt, you didn't get a word in. So I'm working on that. It could be I listen attentively without getting lost in my thoughts. You think about what intention you would like to carry out and just take one thing. Don't try to make a big project out of this. Take one thing as basic and simple as possible so that you don't set unrealistic goals for yourself. Carry the card around with you or make duplicates. Keep one at home, one in your car, one by your nightstand, one in your pocket or your purse, and any other place where you'll be sure to see it as a reminder. And just try it out and see what happens. I mean, it doesn't cost anything. You even got a free card. And you might get great benefits from it. Another way to set the tone of your daily intention is to chant the precepts after you sit in meditation. You can do it in Pali or in English. And again, it basically serves as a reminder. You also can say, this is something I do when I'm finished with my meditation, and then I do some loving kindness, and then I do a gratitude. And one of the things that I'm grateful for is this day of life. May I live it mindfully, equanimously, compassionately, and may I speak wisely without anger, hatred, resentment, or ill will, etc., etc. And you can make up your own phrase when you finish your meditation, just as a little reminder. Think of different ways to remember whatever your intention is throughout the day. You can program something to pop up on your computer screen if you're in front of your computer all day. You know how some people wear a colored bracelet which indicates a health condition in case of an emergency? You can make your own bracelet if you're creative. And every time you see your bracelet, it's a reminder about your intention. Or take an activity that you perform every day, several times a day, and let that serve to remind you of your intention. It could be whenever you brush your teeth, or whenever you turn a light on or off, or open or close a door, or every time you go to the bathroom. Whatever it is, just pick something. There's no limit to what you can do. All you have to do is be creative. And don't feel discouraged when you find yourself slipping, as I did today with my dog. Spiritual practice moves in a spiral fashion, not on a linear track. Some of the people I interviewed are well into their 80s, and they're still working on right speech. I think that may have been the most wonderful thing I got out of my whole doctoral research. That when I interviewed these people about perfecting right speech, not one of them said that he or she had perfected it. There was so much humility. And I thought, wow, if Aitken Roshi in his 80s is still working on it, okay, I can breathe with a sigh of relief that I haven't perfected it yet, that it's just it's an ongoing practice. So don't feel discouraged. And do feel encouraged. Like whenever you notice that you're fulfilling the intention you've set, just feel encouraged. It's not an ego trip to acknowledge when you do something wholesome. I mean, the Buddha said it's good to feel happy and glad when you're aware of being compassionate or patient or generous or virtuous, because that gladness reinforces the wholesome act. And it can lead to repeating it again and again. I would like to end with a quote from Lama Kunga. He is in his 70s. And this is a speech ideal that he still aspires to help establish happiness in others. He says, "The highest speech is to be a good person and to be kind to one another. To comprehend or understand each other in a positive way through speech, to attain that goal of happiness in their life. Happiness is something everybody tries to achieve." Thank you. Do you have any questions? I am not a Dharma teacher. I'm a yogi who has practiced and studied. But I'm not a Dharma teacher. I'll still try to answer your questions the best I can.
What's the difference between going to your boss who you thought bad thoughts about and saying good things and a reaction formation?
I'm not...
Formation is pretending that you... the opposite of what you really feel for a person. Pretending that you feel good about them.
I don't know whether it's about pretending. I mean, in this particular case, Paul thought it over first.
Right. Okay.
So I... But, you know, there is some validity. I've heard this again and again in spiritual practice, that sometimes you don't really feel it, but if you do it long enough, it becomes that. For example, when you're doing metta practice, the metta may not feel all gushy, warm in your heart, and, you know, as you're picturing someone, but over time, it deepens.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions?
I just had a question of the book that you're currently working on, which is on the dissertation of speech. When do you project that coming out?
Oh, well, the book I'm working on right now is the Manindra book. I'm almost done with that. And the book on speech was something I was supposed to do years. The dissertation was done years ago, but I was supposed to then do a book on that. And I wound up having to set it aside to do the Manindra book. So I hope to get back to it when the Manindra book is done. Anything else? Yes?
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the congruence between being a yogi and studying some dharma or insight meditation, and how those go together for you. Because I came to this practice from a yoga practice, and I see a lot of similarities, but I don't know enough about each of the teachings to see how similarly they are. They seem to go together very well, though.
When I say yogi is just a word that we use as Dharma students, not as a yoga student. We just call ourselves yogis. So I don't know that I could answer your question in that way. I mean, I've done yoga for decades, but I think it's a really personal integration. I think yoga is really helpful for practice, because practice is not about being up here. It's about being in the whole body. Mindfulness is in the whole body. And I think yoga can really help in that way.
Thank you.
Sure. If there are no more questions, let's just do a moment of metta before we say goodnight. May all beings at IMC and all beings in Redwood City and all beings in California and all beings across the country and all beings throughout the world, may all beings be happy. May all beings know peace, and may all beings be free from mental and physical suffering. And may the merit of our practice here tonight be dedicated to the welfare, the happiness, and the freedom from suffering for all beings. Thank you.